and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Yupik storyteller and playwright Jack Dalton, hosted by the Smithsonian Arctic Studies Center as part of the Smithsonian Spotlight Lecture Series, Jack's talk on the future of tradition was recorded on November 1st at the Anchorage Museum.
Well, welcome everyone. This is the Smithsonian Spotlight Series, our monthly lectures. I'm Aaron Kroll, the director of the Smithsonian Arctic Studies Center program here. And so, welcome tonight. And our guest tonight is Jack Dalton. It's a real treat to have him here. Jack comes from multiple worlds, rooted in Hooper Bay, born in Bethel, and raised in Anchorage. He's grown up as an ambassador between his Yupik Inuit and European heritages. Jack is a professional storyteller, actor, writer, teacher, and director. He's received numerous honors and awards, including the title of Distinguished Dignitary of the World Indigenous Peoples Conference on Education, and the first expressive arts grants from the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. He's created and produced theatrical works, written a book, and taught creative writing to tens of thousands of students around the world. And his play, Raven's Radio Hour, you may be familiar with, which he co-wrote and stars in, has been performed internationally in Australia and at the Scottish International Storytelling Festival, where it headlined. His play, Time Immemorial, premiered at Cyrenos in 2009 and was selected as part of the Autry National Center's Native Voices Festival of New Plays. Assimilation, his fourth play, was selected as one of the top five cultural events of 2010 by the Anchorage Daily News. And he is working on another production, Where Is My Drum, which is currently in development and co-written with Stephen Blanchett. And he's currently a member of the Alaska Native Playwrights Project and working on another play, The Last of His Kind, and an opera also. So please welcome Jack Dalton.
Good evening. Thank you for having me here tonight. I'm really excited to be sharing what I'll be sharing today. It's very rare that I'm standing behind a lectern. And I find myself actually nervous behind here. Usually if I'm out there telling a story, it's like, oh yeah, I can do that, no problem. But being behind a lectern, which I'm probably gonna not be behind for very long. Very, very, very glad to be here. Little change in what you said there. Raven's Radio Hour hasn't been to all those amazing places yet, but I have performed in Australia and Scotland and all those wonderful places, so that just wanted to make sure that was correct. So as you said in there, I've taught, we've done the calculations, it's over, I think now it's almost 30,000 students around the world I have taught creative writing to, which, you know, you go to a school, you work with 300-400 kids, and then you move on to the next school, and you don't realize how quickly those hundreds and hundreds of students start adding up when you've worked with each of them on creative writing. But one of the most valuable to me, the most fulfilling to me, is actually going out to the villages and working with our kids in the village. And that's what tonight is about. It's about how our young Native people in Alaska are taking their knowledge of their culture and learning about the art of story and storytelling and creating new stories, stories that will be the traditions of the future. This is a picture of Delawagai, the late Delawagai from St. Lawrence Island, and I just had to put a picture of her in here just because she was one of my beloved elders and I learned so much from her, and she definitely was a true elder, and I love telling stories about things I learned from her. She just had a way of talking to you that you just listened to her. You just couldn't help it. Just a real quick story about Della is I was working at the Alaska Native Heritage Center, and it was right in that time of my career as a storyteller where I was trying to figure out, am I doing the right thing? Am I not doing the right thing? You know, the last thing I want to do is kind of sell out my culture and or minimize it in some way by attaching monetary value to it and getting paid for it. And Della was sitting there working on some mittens, and this woman walked up, one of those tourists that's experiencing their vacation behind the scream of a camcorder. And the lady looking through the camcorder said to Della, oh, you're, and of course in the loud tourists, obviously you can't understand me, so if I speak a lot louder, you can understand me, said, oh, you're making those to sell in the gift shop, aren't you? And Della, being Della, you can just imagine her doing this. She gently set down her work, and she looked up at this woman, and she had that thing with her eye, and her head shook a little bit, and she looked up at that woman like that, and the woman suddenly put the camcorder down and looked at Della, and Della said, yes, it is true that we sell some of the things like this in the gift shop, but you must remember, that is not who we are. And I think that carries so much wisdom. For me, it was the wisdom of getting paid to be a storyteller, to perform our traditional stories, just a way in which the Western world is saying thank you. In traditional times, we would have had some other kind of trade or barter or something like that. So the fact that that's not the way it works now, and I'm getting paid, it doesn't have to define me, my culture, or anything like that. It's a game that we play in the Western world in order to survive. But of course, I think there's so much more to that. And I, in terms of the challenges that we're facing as Alaska Native peoples today, that those challenges don't have to define who we are. Because I think that a lot of times in today's world, a lot of people are defining themselves by the issues that we're facing. As an example of this, of not being defined by what's going on in your world, is the story of Fox and Squirrel. And it's I'll just tell you this little story here about Fox and Squirrel. Now, Fox was, and Squirrel were best friends. And they did everything together. They grew up together. They were just, you couldn't separate them. They just were the best of friends. And Fox one day was out in the forest and found these mushrooms and decided to eat one of these mushrooms. Now, when Fox ate this mushroom, kind of changed the way Fox went about things in the world. And Squirrel noticed this and said, Fox, what did you do? And Fox said, well, I just ate this mushroom. It's what's happening to me is really cool. And Squirrel said, I don't know. I don't think that this is a good idea. I really wish you wouldn't eat these mushrooms anymore. And Fox said, you know, hey, I can do whatever I want. You know, you can't tell me that I can't do something. You don't own me. And so it kind of put a little wedge in between Fox and Squirrel. Well, Fox went out another day and found some more mushrooms and ate those mushrooms and had that same weird effect. And, you know, was going along and saw Squirrel, and Squirrel just said, Fox, you are my best friend, and I just don't like you eating these mushrooms. I wish you would stop eating these mushrooms. And Fox was, you know, he was a little bit stranger this time, and he said, you can't tell me what to do. And in his anger, Fox kind of lunged towards Squirrel, and Squirrel just sort of jumped out of the way. And this kind of, you know, the fact that Fox couldn't get Squirrel, it kind of made him upset, and he got a little bit more mad and sort of went after Squirrel again. And Squirrel defended himself, and because Fox was acting a little strange, you know, squirrel was able to beat him really, really easily. And this made Fox feel really, really bad, and he went back out into the woods, and after a while, he was sitting there in his anger, and he ate some more of those mushrooms, and then as he was being getting, you know, strange again, he ate some more mushrooms and ate some more mushrooms, and till finally he got so angry, he was so enraged by the fact that, you know, he was beat up by a little squirrel, that he stormed through the woods and found Squirrel and just beat the tar out of Squirrel. So bad that Squirrel had to go to the hospital. Now, when Fox sort of was normal again, he went to the hospital, and the wolf, who was the doctor, came up to Fox and said, "You know, this was really bad. Your friend is hurt really, really bad, and we're actually not certain that Squirrel is going to make it. And you do realize that this happened because you were eating those mushrooms, and you should really consider that, because this is just not a good situation." And Fox went and saw his little friend Squirrel laying there in the little squirrel hospital bed, his leg up in a cast. And Fox just felt terrible. He went back out into the woods and just was having that horrible feeling of guilt and remorse and sadness for his friend. And he thought, you know, if I eat some mushrooms, then I'll probably feel better. And so Fox went and found some mushrooms and ate those and got strange again. But that didn't make Fox feel any better. In fact, he kind of felt worse. And then he thought, well, it's just because I haven't had enough mushrooms yet. So he went and he found more mushrooms and he ate those. And that didn't work. So he went and he found more mushrooms and he ate those. But instead of actually feeling better, he was starting to feel much, much worse. More sadness, more remorse, more guilt. And he just kept thinking, well, I just haven't eaten enough mushrooms yet. And so Fox found more mushrooms and more mushrooms and more mushrooms and ate them all. In fact, Fox ate so many mushrooms that it made Fox very, very sick. And so Fox ended up in the hospital. The wolf doctor came in and said, "Fox, this is really bad. You ate so many mushrooms, it's poisoned you. And we've tried to get all the poison out, but there's some of it we just can't get out, and we don't know if you're actually going to make it." Now, Fox felt terrible about this. And one day, Squirrel came into Fox's hospital room in his little squirrel wheelchair, his leg up in the cast. His squirrel came in and went up to the bed that Fox was in and reached out his little squirrel paw and put it on Fox's arm and said, "Fox, do you get it now? Do you understand now? Do you see what's happened here? This has happened because you were eating those mushrooms. I'm in the hospital, you're in the hospital. I'm going to be okay now, but they don't know if you're going to be okay. And this happened because you ate those mushrooms. I told you not to eat those mushrooms." Fox just felt so bad, and he said, I know, I should have listened to you. But the way I felt eating those mushrooms was just so much fun, I thought. But now that I see what's happened, I just feel terrible that I ever ate those mushrooms." And Squirrel said, "Fox, my friend, I need you to promise me above everything else that you will never, ever, ever eat another mushroom like that again." And Fox looked at his friend Squirrel and said, "I promise you, my friend Squirrel, I promise I will never, ever eat another mushroom like that again." And Squirrel believed Fox. Unfortunately, Fox didn't make it. Fox died. And Squirrel felt so bad about his friend dying because of these mushrooms that Squirrel decided to spend the rest of his life traveling throughout the forest and telling the story of what had happened to him and his friend Fox and the mushrooms, in hopes that if he could tell enough animals about what happened, then hopefully none of the other animals would ever want to eat mushrooms like that again. Now, this story, I think it's an absolutely amazing story. And what's amazing about this story even more is that it was created by a group of fourth, fifth, and sixth graders in the village of Tuntutuliak, Alaska. And what's even more so is that these children test at a first and second grade reading level according to standardized tests and are failing most of those standardized tests. But even more so, it's their English language tests, and a lot of these kids speak Yupik, and in a lot of the villages, especially the Lower Kuskokwim School District villages, they actually teach in Yupik through third grade. And they don't start actually learning or having school in English until they get to the fourth grade. Now, luckily, they've gotten the schools that do have the Yupik immersion classes in them, they actually have gotten approval from the Department of Education to give the third grade standardized tests in Yupik. But there's all these arguments about, oh, this puts these kids at a disadvantage, not having English happen from the very beginning, so on and so forth. So they're still trying to figure it out. So this was that class there. You can see the kids here. And the process of creating this story with them was really, really amazing. When we were creating the story, I just asked them, so what happens next? And someone would have an idea, or they would discuss it a little bit, and then let me know what their idea was, and I would write it up on the board. And the site administrator, the principal, said, you know, well, this is that age group. You got the boys in there, a lot of boys in that class, and so you're just going to have to accept that there's going to be a lot of fighting, a lot of violence in this story. And I'm like, yeah, that's fine. And it actually worked out really, really well. Whenever I tell the story, I don't feel like there's a grotesque amount of violence in it. I've seen some stories that kids write that do have way a whole bunch of violence in them. And I try and steer them away from that. Oh, really? I just realized this happened in 2004. It was a long time ago. And the thing that surprised me the most was at the end of the story, and I said, okay, you know, Fox is in the hospital now. What happens next? And the kids actually discussed it for a little while and finally said, we think Fox should die. And there just seemed to be something so wise about that. And I still remember I turned around to write on the board, Fox dies. And all I kept telling myself was, don't cry, Jack. Don't cry. Don't cry. Not in front of the kids. But I was just so moved by their decision and then the further decision that Squirrel would spend the rest of his life traveling around telling the story and actually using storytelling as a means of teaching the lesson of what happened to his friend Fox. Now, what's interesting about this is usually at these schools, I give end of the residency performance and for the entire community. And usually I tell a story of my own as like a public performance. But in Tuntutuliak, I decided, no, I'm going to tell this story that the kids have created, stories that the kids have created. And I told this story. And after I told this story, the whole gymnasium was just dead silent. And the site administrator came to me and said, you just rocked this village's world. And I looked at her, I said, no, I didn't rock this village's world. These kids just rocked their village's world. because what happens in that story are things that actually, that the kids are aware of going on in the village. And that's what I think is really, really amazing, is how aware young people are. We keep saying, you know, people keep saying, you know, oh, well, they're just kids. They don't really understand what's going on. No way. They know exactly what's going on. Ah, so welcome to Tuntutuliak, Alaska. Unfortunately, Ira doesn't fly these wonderful little twin otters anymore. So usually you're in a Piper Navajo or something. But back in 2004, they were still flying the twin otters. So if you haven't been out to a village, if you haven't experienced a village for yourself yet, we're going to give you just a little tour here. So this is Tuntutuliak International Airport. The runway is probably about 2,000 feet long or a little bit less, gravel or mud in some cases, or snow this time of year. And there's no terminal building. You just get off of the plane and hopefully there's someone there to pick you up, either on a snow machine or a four-wheeler or sometimes even a car. There was one time I arrived at a village where the airport was about a mile from the village, and they didn't know I was on that flight. So I walked across the snow for a mile to get to the village. That was a lot of fun. So you can see the houses, BIA houses out there. These houses actually look like they're in pretty good shape. There are a lot of villages where the houses are in much, much greater disrepair. And of course, they're on stilts to make sure that they don't melt the permafrost, which would create a whole bunch of issues. You can see the boardwalks there. People walk around on the boardwalks, drive on the boardwalks even. The only communication is through satellite, although now GCI has a new network, the Terra Network, that has brought microwave broadband to a lot of the villages in the Kuskokwim Delta region. This is the school, and this school was actually, this was a pretty good school. Again, some of the schools are pretty old, and some of them are too small. The villages are actually growing quite quickly, and so some of the schools are really overcrowded. This one was actually doing okay. That's where I stayed, one of the teacher housing units. You can see the plywood that was put on it, because when no one was living there, it got vandalized pretty quickly. When I was there, they were working on some murals to go on the wall, and this was one of the murals they were working on, a traditional parka, fancy dancing parka. Okay, so storytelling. Why is storytelling such a wonderful form of education? And so we'll just go through this. Again, I'm still in my, I'm giving a lecture, I'm really nervous mode. But so the motive for storytelling, for traditional stories, was to teach lessons. There's always some kind of lesson in the story. And oftentimes it wasn't just a lesson, but there was also a lot of factual information in stories. For instance, take a story like The Boy Who Ate Too Much, where the boy has survived a winter of starvation and has to go out and hunt, and everything he hunts, he eats. And in the traditional way of telling that story, you would actually spend a lot of time on each of the animals that he hunts in order to explain the lifestyle of the animals, what the animal can be used for, the best way of approaching the animal when you're hunting it. I mean, just so much information packed into these stories, as well as the main lesson and peripheral lessons. Stories are great at teaching in a way that you don't know that you're being taught. And it's always great to be in a room full or a gymnasium full of elementary school kids and have them sit there for 90 minutes on a concrete floor and be wrapped by a story. And I always make sure I tell the administrators and the teachers afterwards, I say, you do realize that was 90 minutes, and that's the same length of time of most animated feature films. So I don't, you know, I'm one of those people, I don't like hearing that the kids don't have the attention spans they used to and so on and so forth. It's like, they do, they can sit. They can sit and concentrate for very, very long periods of time if we approach it a certain way. So to me, the things that make stories really, really effective are the idea of metaphor and human experience. And the metaphor and the human experience do two things for us. The metaphor does what I call separates the people from the problem. Okay? So instead of talking about, you know, so-and-so in the community who's this way and that way and shouldn't be doing this and shouldn't be doing that, you say Fox was doing this and doing that because no one knows who you're talking about. Or you might be talking about more than one person. Maybe there's a problem in the village, and by using the metaphor, you're able to talk about the problem without confronting anyone. And so that's what we call separating the people from the problem. But then you have a lot of human experiences in the stories. Okay, in this particular story of Fox and Squirrel, there was the guilt, there was the sadness, the feeling strange, the being worried, the being angry, so on and so forth. All of those are human experiences, human emotions. And you'll find in a lot of stories, you'll find those human experiences in the story, because what this does is help people identify with the main character or the characters, depending on the story. And by identifying with those characters, they're able to learn the lesson that the characters learn without having to go through it themselves. I always like to say that our ancestors were so brilliant because they figured out that we don't have to make the same mistake generation after generation after generation. That once we've figured out the best way to go about something, then we can tell stories in order to teach those lessons, because if you tell the story well enough, then you actually have a visceral experience of whatever happens in the story, and whatever is learned in the story, you can then avoid yourself. You don't have to make that same mistake that the character or characters made in the story in order to learn the lesson, which I just think is utterly brilliant. And then, of course, humor and repetition. Repetition is incredibly important in stories. And so, like in this fox and squirrel story, there's the fox always going out to get the mushrooms and always being confronted by squirrel. You know, so there's that constant repetition within the story itself. And then humor. Humor is really important in a lot of stories because the more you laugh, tends to then they've actually done science, a brain science that says when people are laughing, they've done MRI scans to show there's actual brain activity, increased brain activity going on. So you laugh more, you're going to learn more and remember it for a longer period of time. Which means I should say something funny right now, huh?
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Yupik storyteller and playwright Jack Dalton. His talk on the future of tradition was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on November 1st.
All right. I do what I call values-based writing. In other words, you start with the value, and then you work from that. So whenever I have the working with the kids, the first thing I do is we talk about values, what's important about values, lessons, morals, and we usually make a really long list of different kinds of lessons that you can learn in a story, and then I have them choose one. For instance, the story of the fox and squirrel came from the thing that these kids in these schools just get pounded into their heads all the time, don't do drugs, don't do drugs, don't do drugs. And yes, it's one thing to have that repetition of a lesson like that in that way, but there's also something that can be a little bit, don't do drugs is just kind of it's not as strong as it could be. So these kids took that lesson, don't do drugs, and they turned it into that amazing story. So I say it's similar to mystery writing because you decide what the value is first. In other words, like a mystery novel, we know you know before you even write the first page that it was Professor Plum in the library with the lead pipe. And then based on that, you go to the beginning and weave things in a way so that you can have that discovery at the end of the story. But you want to know the ending of the story before you get started. Here are these kids in Tuntutuliak really diligently working away at their worksheets. One of my favorite moments in teaching, I forget where it was, I think it was out in Eagle River, and a fourth grade boy raised his hand. And I said, yes. And he said, Mr. Dalton, this is starting to feel less like art and more like school. I was so proud of that. So when I first started teaching back in 2001, the village of Tununik was the first village I actually taught at. The site administrator, Gail, called me up. I knew I was going out to the Lower Kuskokwim region for 2 weeks, but I didn't quite know what I was doing those entire 2 weeks. I knew I was going around to different villages, but Tununik wanted me to be there for an entire week. So I called up the site administrator and I said, you know, a week is a really long time and I don't know that many stories. I don't have enough stories to go for an entire week. And she said, oh no, I don't want you to just tell stories to my kids. I want you to teach them how to create their own stories. And I said, oh, okay, I'll get started on that. And so I had about a week to create my first draft of the creative writing curriculum. And at the time, I remembered being a kid and doing creative writing in school, and I couldn't stand all of the rules that were involved and all of the structure. I wanted just to get an idea and just start writing about it. And so this, I was like, I'm going to liberate these children from all these rules and structure that they give in these creative writing courses. And so I tried that out and it failed miserably because these kids without the structure were just lost. They'd start, you know, once upon a time there was a cat and a dog and a mouse and they lived in a house on the hill and then they would just start writing and it just got completely lost. So I then retooled it over the years so that it's a really very structured curriculum now. They're essentially plugging in ideas into worksheets. And I mean, I'm not giving them the answers. It's actually a lot harder than that. But they have a very, very good foundation. And I was worried at first that by having this foundation that every student was using in the same way, that they weren't going to, you know, I was going to get 30 stories or 200 stories that were all exactly the same. But it's like a house. You can start with a very basic structure, the skeleton of a house, and then the color you paint it, the kind of trim you have on it, the kind of siding you put on it, the kind of roof you put on it, I mean, the way you decorate the inside, you can have countless versions of a thing called a house. And it's that same way with the writing method that I use, that even by having such a stringent structure, they're able to be creative. And it's great because there are a lot of kids who don't think that they're creative. And by using the curriculum, they can actually, they do something that's actually really wonderful and creative. This was the middle school class, and it was great because the teacher, she was a white woman, but she grew up in Bethel, so she was fluent in Yupik, and the kids always forgot this, so they'd be trying to talk behind the teacher's back in Yupik, or in front of the teacher's back in Yupik, and the teacher would always just shake her head and start speaking fluent Yupik to them, so they couldn't get away with anything. Poor kids. What I've noticed is how well this kind of creative writing curriculum works with at-risk students. These are students in rural areas, in inner city schools. I was in Lynn, Massachusetts, which is about 95% immigrant population, low-income immigrant populations. And, you know, I had a group of students, high school students, that were just atrocious. Like, I had to stop and, like, you know, just sort of berate them a number of times. But as soon as they started writing, as soon as they started really working on the curriculum, they just created some amazing stories. And I found that the best stories tend to come from the students that seem to be the most at risk. And I think what it is because it's a relatively simple thing to follow, that they're able to express what they're going through creatively and in a safe way, so that, you know, obviously any psychologist would look at it or a social worker would look at it and go, oh, so this is what's going on in their life. But they don't realize that, and so to them, they're able to express these ideas and still feel safe. I was one of the kids who helped create the fox and the squirrel story. So the first thing that we do, as I said before, is you choose the value, the lesson, or the moral of the story. And so in this case, it was don't do drugs. And then you figure out when I started out, the last thing I wanted to do was to have one of those long, silly names for something. And I ended up, I still haven't changed it, with something called the Value Learning Process Map. And I keep hoping one day I'm just gonna wake up and go, oh, that's what I can call it, that's so much better than Value Learning Process Map. But it's the way in it's looking at a value and figuring out how that value is learned, and it ends up being the basis for the story. And let's see if I okay. So, and I always try and keep it as simple as possible. So if your lesson is don't do drugs, then the problem at the beginning of your story is someone is doing drugs, and then I have them come up with the natural consequences for somebody doing the wrong thing. So in the case of doing drugs, the things they came up with was someone could get hurt, someone could die, people won't want to be your friend, and they came up with those, and those were ended up being the ones that we used in the story. Now, one of the most important things I tell the kids is absolutely no punishment whatsoever. That in these stories, the character is not going to learn the lesson by being punished. They're going to learn through these natural consequences, because that's about power. Punishment, in order for punishment to happen, you have to have someone who has more power than you. And the automatic response to punishment is defense or rebellion. And so that doesn't create a very good learning situation. But if you have natural consequences that are not coming from a power, then what happens is the character or the child or whoever, we still learn this way too, is that we go, oh, well, maybe I'm feeling so bad because all these things are happening to me. And it's no one's fault, it's just the natural consequences. Maybe if I change my ways, then I won't feel this way anymore because those things won't be happening to me. And so that is why punishment is not, we don't want punishment in these stories. Ah, there, I just explained it to you. Learning through self-realization. This is one of the most PowerPointy presentations I have ever given. I'm usually not a PowerPointy person. All right. So based on the value learning process map, that's when they choose characters. But before they actually choose their characters, we want to know who's needed. And not, you know, oh, well, we need a dog. No. What characters are required for the story to actually happen? And so we look at the value learning process map. So if the problem at the beginning of the story is someone is doing drugs, then who's needed is someone who's going to do drugs. Okay, and then in this case we had the victim, which ended up being Squirrel, and a wise one, which was the wolf, the doctor. And then after we figure out who's needed in the story, that's when we go back and we look at archetypes. And the great thing about archetypes is that when we say fox, everyone knows what kind of character fox is going to be. And not only is it because of all the history of stories that we have about foxes being sly and tricky and smart and all that, being thieves, but you actually can see how that came to be based on the way the animals actually are in nature. Now, the issue is that foxes really aren't, they're not, a fox who steals from the chicken coop isn't actually stealing from the chicken coop. The fox is being a fox and is getting food. It just so happens it's in a chicken coop, so it had to figure out how to get it. But the fox isn't sitting there going, ha, 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 I'm going to steal from the farmer and get these chickens. And so, in a way, it's not fair to poor fox that he has this reputation. But it doesn't matter because fox doesn't, you know, and when talking to the kids about this, they're like, well, fox doesn't understand us. I'm like, exactly. We could sit there and see a fox in the wild and say, you're a tricky, sly, lying thief. And the fox would just go about its business. Whereas, if we used people in these stories and we gave them human names, you know, so Dan went out and ate mushrooms. Well, what if there's a Dan in your circle, in your community, and so Dan might think that you're talking about him, and then that's not very good. Also, when we use humans, oftentimes we fall into stereotype as opposed to archetype. And of course, stereotypes are not very helpful either. So the archetypes are great in a couple of ways. One, you don't have to explain the character. Everyone knows exactly what the character's like. And two, it keeps things from getting uncomfortable due to stereotypes and people feeling like maybe that story's about them. And then after the characters are chosen, that's when they figure out the plot of the story, what happens. We draw a plot line and fill all that in, and then they write their first or rough draft. There, those kids, they were really good and wrote their first draft. They were so proud of themselves. All right. Then we go back and we have these different exercises that help them with dialogue, description, and details. And then from there, they get to go and write further drafts. And then when they're lucky, they get to actually make books and draw pictures. So these are the students of Tuntutuliak. Really cute kids. I've seen some of these kids recently, and it's like, wow, you've grown up. They're like, yeah, I remember you when you came and I was in kindergarten. I was like, it wasn't really that long ago, was it? Yeah, it was that long ago. So in the fall of 2003 and the spring of 2004, I went to the village of Northway and did this same process with the students there and got a few really interesting stories out of it. And so just as examples, I'd like to share a couple of those stories with you. One of them is called No Fighting, and it's by Jessica Sam. Northway, if you don't know where that is, if you are headed to the Canadian border on the Alaska Highway, it's halfway between halfway between Tok and the Canadian border there. And it's a Upper Tanana village, Athabascan village. This next story here is called The Drunk Caribou. And this is one of those stories where, for some reason, I don't have the words on the slides. And the book, which is usually sitting with this one on my desk, wasn't there. So now I'm going to have to remember this poor story from memory, and which is too bad because Kaylee actually did a wonderful job when she wrote this story. But I will give you more or less the synopsis. So The Drunk Caribou, written and illustrated by Kaylee Hildebrand from Northway. So Caribou was always drinking. And Squirrel didn't like this very much. In fact, it was quite embarrassing. There were often times when Squirrel would go out onto the porch and Caribou would be laying there drunk on the porch. and usually sometimes singing a silly song like doo-da, doo-da, doo-da. Or when Squirrel would come home and find the place was a wreck and there were bottles and cans everywhere. Or even worse, when she would wake up in the morning, go out, and find Caribou and all of Caribou's friends passed out in the living room. I love those little, it's amazing what little X's for eyes can do to really get information across. So Caribou didn't come home one day, and Squirrel ended up getting really, really worried and called around asking if anyone had seen where Caribou had gone. Don't you love that the squirrel was able to talk on the phone without actually holding it? That is brilliance. Finally, after looking everywhere, Squirrel found Caribou. Caribou was at the old play fort and was drinking and singing a silly song, doo-da, doo-da, doo-da. Squirrel said, "Caribou, you have got to stop drinking." And Caribou said, "I don't care." Squirrel finally decided that if Caribou was going to keep drinking, then Squirrel was going to leave. Squirrel was going to move out. And so she packed up all of her things. When Caribou finally came home, it was quiet in the house. The only sound was the sound of the wind and a paper flying by on the ground, tumbling around. Caribou called out, "Squirrel, are you there?" But when Caribou went inside, Squirrel was gone. The only thing that was left was a note that Squirrel had written. Caribou read it, and it said, "I can't take you continuing to drink anymore, and so I finally have to leave. But if you get better, then maybe I'll consider coming back." So Caribou called up the wise owl to get help. And the owl said, "This is going to be a lot of work, but I think I can help you out." Don't you like that the caribou was able to talk on the phone without even having the mouthpiece where it's supposed to be? I thought her illustrations were brilliant. So Owl came over to help out Caribou. The first thing Owl said was, "Oh my goodness, I can't believe what a mess this place is. The very first thing you're going to have to do is to clean up. Oh, and by the way, I brought this bottle of medicine, and it's going to make you not want to drink anymore." You can see the little bottle of medicine right there next to the owl, who's shocked at the mess that Caribou has made. After Caribou cleaned, the owl is very wise and knows how to talk on the telephone. The owl finally saw that Caribou was doing better, keeping the place clean and not drinking anymore. And so Owl called Squirrel and said that Caribou had changed and that it was okay to come back home. Squirrel came back, but when she got there, the house was completely and totally quiet. She thought, "Oh no, maybe Caribou has gone back out drinking again. Maybe I shouldn't have come back." But when she got inside, both Owl and Caribou shouted, "Surprise!" And Squirrel and Caribou were so happy to see each other again. And Caribou said to Squirrel, "I promise you, I am never going to drink again." Now, usually when people hear this story for the first time, they think it's really quite a funny story. And it is a funny story. It's a really wonderful, well-written story. And hopefully you didn't mind my paraphrasing. I remembered some of the things that she wrote down exactly, the song Doodah Doodah, and oh, by the way, I just happened to bring this medicine that will help you stop drinking. Those were actually things that she wrote. So everyone thinks the story is funny, but now reread that story in your mind and realize that that student actually probably dealt with those situations herself, actually found a parent or a relative passed out on the front steps, or they didn't come home for several days, or having to get up in the morning and tell your parents and all their friends that they need to go home now because they're passed out on the living room floor. And suddenly you realize how amazing these stories are at helping these young people express what they're going through, but also to do it in a way that at face value doesn't hit as hard. The story and the wonderful illustrations actually sort of protect us from the realization of what's really going on. But what Kaylee also did was she also put in a really, really great tradition from the Upper Tanana culture, and that is by having the caribou be the drunk one. And the reason why is because the Tanana people and a lot of the other Athabascan people think that caribous are stupid, and that's why they're so easy to corral and so easy to take for food. And so when you want to insult someone in that culture, what you do is you call them a caribou head, because essentially you're saying, you're just being stupid, you're being a caribou head. And so by having the caribou be the drunk one and the one who has to learn the lesson is coming straight from her culture and symbol that's well known. And squirrels are thought to be very, very smart because they have to figure a lot of things out and they have to gather a lot of food. So she was using archetypes within her own culture that actually worked out really, really well. That maybe needed to be explained on our part, but once we know, it's really, really quite cool. So what is my eventual dream working with students like this? I would absolutely love one day to be able to actually publish some of these books. I've gotten to a point where I read children's books and I think, you know, what are you doing? You know, you're writing these books and you're simplifying everything and it's just not as good a story anymore. Whereas you read these children, I mean, even the story of the fox and the squirrel is a pretty complicated story with some pretty complicated words in it. I mean, when I was writing down the words, they knew big words and they were using them. They knew these complicated concepts. And so I always thought it would be great. Why don't we have children writing children's books? The idea would be that when the sales happened, that a percentage of the profits would go to an education fund for the student who wrote that particular story. And this education fund wouldn't necessarily be only for college. I think college is a really wonderful thing to do, but a lot of kids may not actually find college that useful. Perhaps it's more of a vocational education they would like, or I am 100% for experiential learning. I was an exchange student in Sweden right after high school, and it was one of the most important formative years of my life. In fact, so much of what I do now as a person is based on the things that I learned in Sweden. So that's something that this could be. It might also be something that they want to buy an instrument or take art classes or something like that. That's not quite the same as, you know, going to get a degree at a four-year college. Then another percentage of the profits would go to a fund at the school, which would help with arts education, leadership programs, and travel to broaden the students' views of the world, and also to bring in other artists in residence to work with their school. And if all those things happen, and eventually I believe that they will, then maybe we'll all live happily ever after. Koyana, thank you very much.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Yupik storyteller and playwright Jack Dalton. You can find a link to his slideshow presentation, including some of the children's books he read, at alaskapublic.org. Hosted by the Smithsonian Arctic Studies Center as part of the Smithsonian Spotlight Lecture Series, Jack's talk on the future of tradition was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on November 1, 2012, and shortened for broadcast on KSKA. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.